You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, you're here again with another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. I thank you again for joining me, like every time. I think it's always very important to say thank you to everyone. And this week we are continuing the description of some of the sacrifices. Obviously last week I tried to cover as much as I can. I might touch again on a few details from last week's parasha. This week's parasha is parasha Tzav. Tzav really comes from the root tzava, which is to command, which is the same root as the word mitzvah. And basically Moshe has been told to command Aaron and his sons over certain details of the sacrifices. Now, I find this very intriguing because this actually goes directly only to the Kohanim, while in the previous parasha, because there are details that deal directly with what the owner can do, as we've pointed out, that the owner puts his hand over the sacrifice, that the owner can probably slaughter and even take the animal apart. Here, this already deals with things which are directly connected to the Kohanim themselves, and the owner is never really involved. The few things that I do want to touch on from last week, just continuing some of the points made there, is first of all, this detail that we have in chapter 5, because I went through some details here on the previous sacrifices. I actually skipped over sacrifices which were brought for public sin, and there are a few, because we're already going over the time, because I had to speak about a few other details, but one of the things that really I find very interesting, and I think people kind of miss out on this one, is the concept of responsibility, but also the allowance of mistake. So we actually have three sacrifices in last week's parasha that deal with certain individuals that, two individuals and a populace that if they make a mistake, there actually is a way to repent over it. And I think that one of the problems religious people have, and I'm using the word religious very broadly, is that religious people try to find try to find the best way of doing everything, try to prevent any form of mistake. And really, you know, when I make a mistake, I learn from my mistake. This is something I developed throughout the years. I try not to repeat the same mistake twice. Try to, let's emphasize that. For example, when I was working in restaurants, for those who don't know, I'm also a trained chef, and I went to culinary school. And, I worked in restaurants. And in restaurants, there's a high possibility of making a mistake. Why? Because it's a lot of pressure. You have to make instantaneous decisions. You know, if something goes wrong here, how do I fix it without having to throw out the dish? How do I, you know, if a plate comes back, to analyze what went wrong with the plate and things of that nature. And, you know, making decisions if you have 8, 9, 10 things on a burner to make sure your mind is set on everything. And believe me, I've burnt things. And I had to redo, and you know, I always told my boss, if I ever make serious mistakes, you can take it off my check. And my boss never actually did that. Very nice people, but you know, you make mistakes, and I did cause some damage, and you learn from these mistakes. But the thing is that what's very important to realize is that the Torah is very, very human, in the sense that if you make a mistake, there's always a way of repenting. There's always a way of fixing it. And even sometimes people that you don't expect them to make mistakes, people who are on a higher level or higher scale than most of us, and in this case specifically, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, depends which period of language you're dealing with, or even a Nasi, which is kind of a quasi-equivalent of a king, they can make mistakes, and they have to repent for these mistakes. And for example, one of the dilemmas that came up, and this is something I'm actually writing a paper about, is, you know, leaders making mistakes. You know, specifically, the issue I'm dealing with is, and it's ironic, but it's the calendar. And what happens if the Kohen Gadol, you know, if we're talking about the temple period, makes a mistake about the calendar, and everyone goes out and celebrates feasts at the wrong time, and suddenly, oops, we realize we made a mistake. What do you do with that? Well, first of all, it's a mistake. Nothing was done deliberately. Mistakes are mistakes. And there's always a way around it. So if a high priest makes a mistake, his mistake is a bit more, I would say, high end. So his sacrifice also has to be taken into the temple, which means the moment you take blood into the temple, and this is a rule, the moment you take blood into the temple, if you sprinkle it, if it enters anywhere inside the sanctuary itself, may it be on the altar if we're dealing with Yom Kippurim, or if it's sprinkled in front of the veil, as we have in our case, the first of the sacrifice becomes a sacrifice that has to be completely burnt. The moment you do that, the level of the sacrifice has gone up to such a point that even a Kohen is not allowed to eat it. And but what's very important here is the realization that mistakes are an option. We are human. We make mistakes. That's our reality as a people. And God knows this. Think about Adam and Hava, Adam and Eve. They committed the first sin. And I'm not going to call it original sin. That is a very Christological idea. But they made a mistake. Now, what's interesting is that instead of destroying them, God says, okay, I'm going to send you away from the garden, and you're going to have to live in a completely different world than what you have here. Now, we have no idea how long Adam and Eve actually lived in the garden, but it could have been hundreds of years. Yes, I know the speed up of the storyline makes it look as if they were there for a short time, but in truth, it could be that they were there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. There's actually no way of knowing. But what's very important here is there's some hints in the story itself that indicate that God still cared. The punishment came out of caring. For example, giving them clothing. You know, sending them away and giving them clothing. Sometimes even the sending away is really a gift, because you're now in a state that does not enable you to be in my presence, God would say. Which means punishment is not always necessarily wrathful. It can also sometimes be something that comes out of caring. That there's a certain reality in the universe that does not enable people, you know, human beings, to be in the presence of God, but it doesn't mean that God hates us. And this is the thing. There's a very problematic philosophy about sin that shows up from around the Second Temple. The temple was destroyed. The Jewish people, called Jewish, because really Jews even today are composed from a lot of different tribes. It's a misconception that Jews are only the tribe of Judah. Bits and pieces of Levi and bits and pieces of Benjamin. This is actually completely inaccurate, and there's a lot of information that proves that the Jews of today are clearly composed of all 12 tribes. Obviously, there are other parts of the 12 tribes which are out there somewhere, and some of them are showing up. Some people are waking up to this wanting to keep Torah. It could be that they are descendants. I'm not, you know, for me personally. When the person says they want to be loyal to the Torah and they're removing idolatry and so on, I really don't care if they're from the 10 tribes or not. I accept them. But the thing is that what happened in the Second Temple, which echoes into this very day, is this idea of sin being this ongoing battle that we have. And really, you know, people sin. There's a verse in there's a verse that says that there is no righteous man on earth that does not sin. En tzadik ba'aretz asher lo yachata. I think it's Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, I think, says that. And it's true. People make mistakes. I mean, it's the reality of being human. And you can still be called a righteous person. But what we have today is this obsession. This happens on all ends. This obsession regarding sin, as if it's this paralyzing power that the moment a sin happens, that's it. You're going to be condemned and everything. Why? Where do you even get that from? Look, we even see great people like the Kohen Gadol, like the Nasi, that consent, and there's still an opening to get out of it. So we're slightly immobilized today because there's no temple. But who says that? God is so vengeful that he's not going to give you a way of repenting. He's not going to give you a way around this problem. I just don't see the logic in that. People are so afraid of sin, and I agree. Yes, we should not sin. There's no doubt about that, but we do. And the Torah recognizes this. It knows that we sin. It understands human nature. God understands human nature. And this is why God says, listen, I have to limit your access to me. You have to be limited. You can't go into the temple. You can't, only certain people, certain individuals that I have chosen. God understands human nature. He created us, didn't he? So he understands how we behave. We must avoid sin as much as we can, but at the end of the day, we do sin. It's just our nature. And I'm not saying, oh, here's a free pass to go sin. No, not even close to that. Unfortunately, people misunderstand things like this sometimes and they twist it. And there've been enough cases in history of people misunderstood something someone said or ran off with. I personally had a case about 6 or 7 months ago where someone, I said something, it was completely misunderstood. I get this message, how dare you? I'm like, I never said that. You completely misunderstood what I said. So this is not a free pass to sin. It's an encouragement that even if you've committed sin, even if you've done things in the past, you know, if you have a dark past or something, or even today, if you're doing things which are presumably not allowed, to be encouraged that there's always a way out. There's always a way of repenting. There's always a way to say, listen, I am stopping this and I'm not doing this anymore. And not to think there's going to be any vengeance against you. The vengeance is only on those who rebel, those who openly rebel, who knowingly, not out of personal weakness, but out of a hubris, go and rebel and sin against God. That's already a completely different subject. And I spoke about that last week, that rebellious sin, there's no way of repenting. There's no sacrifice for rebellious sin. But what's very, very important is to understand that there is always a way out. And I've had people break down in tears in front of me, talking about their past and wanting to return to Torah, and people literally crying. And, you have to be human. You have to understand human nature. You have to allow humans to be humans, to really understand that humans have the ability to bring themselves back up, that Israel has the ability to restore itself, that any human being has the ability to restore themselves and go back to a point where they are closer to our original natural state of cleansiness. And this is one of the points of sacrifice. Sacrifice, the word Hebrew word for sacrifice is really korban. A lot of us associate the word sacrifice as giving something from oneself. That's kind of like what we mostly, I mean, at least for me as a person who didn't necessarily grow up in an English-speaking country, but did grow up in an English-speaking environment, that sacrifice is usually associated with the idea of giving from oneself and sacrificing of oneself. It's basically tearing a part of yourself for a greater good. But in Hebrew, korban, though korban does have that association as well, and korban can be associated with someone who is innocent, has been given away. Korban also comes from the word karav. So a lot of questions of etymology are always questions of etymology. But here, the root of korban, the nun is an additional nun. It's part of the nominal paradigms that exist. But the word itself comes from the root karav, which is to draw near. And according to several things that I read, the person who brings a sacrifice is drawing near before God. The altar itself was considered to be a place where there's divine presence, where God actually dwells. And when the person brings a sacrifice, they draw near before the altar, which means they draw near before God. And different cultures had different ways of drawing near. In Israel, because there are no statues and there are no symbols that you can grab a hold of. For example, in certain cultures, you would grab a hold of some kind of a symbol of a deity or even a statue and say certain words like an oath or something like that, and that was really drawing near before you got to an actual statue. In Israel, that doesn't exist. But what's the closest place in Israel I can draw near to that we find? It's the altar, because the altar has divine presence on it because of the fire. And the top of the altar is a place where only a Kohen can actually go, because that's the permission of access that Kohanim have. And the thing that we basically see is that Korban means to draw near. It brings you closer to your God. And in the studies of sacrifices in the ancient world, one of the theories is that the oldest sacrifice is really a Shlamim, a peace offering sacrifice, where one communes with his God, that he eats before his God and he puts part of the food in front of his God and communes with his God, which basically means he draws near to his God. And that's a very, very powerful thing, that we have as humans the ability to draw near to God, even for a short period of time, and kind of return to a more Eden-like state. You know, there is a lot of recordings out there today about the temple being a type of God in Eden. There's nothing new about this. These are researchers that I read, you know, which were written decades ago, but you know, still very valid. But the point about these studies that talk about the temple being a Garden of Eden or an imitation of God in Eden really makes that point, that we draw near to God. What was the difference between Adam and Eve or Adam and Hava before the sin and after the sin? Being in the presence of God. God would walk around the garden to the wind of the day, and man was able to speak directly with God with nothing in between. And then suddenly, it's no more. But the temple gives you the possibility of drawing near, even for a short period of time, to a certain place where there's Kirvat Elohim, know, the nearness of God. And the whole idea of having a temple is trying to create a connection, create an outlet for mankind to connect directly back to God. And the sacrifices are of the nature of drawing near to God and also removing barriers. The sin offerings are basic barrier removers that weave through our sin, create barriers, and the sacrifice enables us to break through these barriers. In any case, we also have another, I'm going to move now to a different subject. We have this intriguing thing where it talks about bringing sacrifices by a specific price. Now, this always intrigued me. What exactly is going on here? So it says in chapter 5, verse 15 says, if a person nefesh kitim ol ma'al, if a person steals, ma'al is a type of thievery that's actually done from something that you're entrusted with. V'hata'a b'shgaga, and sinned by b'shgaga, which is by mistake. And I talked about this last time as well, that we see the person is deliberately taken something that they're forbidden from touching, something that they're entrusted with, but it's still referred to as shgaga. It's still referred to as something which is done shogeg, by mistake, or I would say through weakness. Mikotche Adonai, from the sanctified items of God, basically the treasures, the temple treasures. Vevita Shamol Adonai, he will bring his guilt offering. Okay, this is an offering that's here to express the fact that the person feels guilt. Ail Tamim in Hatson, a unblemished ram from the flock, be'erkecha, by your value, kesef shekalim b'shekel hakodesh la'asham, a silver shekels, the weight of silver, in the holy weight, as a guilt offering. So, what exactly happens here? How do you work through this? So, a person goes and he embezzles. That's the best word for it. Embezzles in temple treasures, of whatever the treasure might be. People bought to temples whatever they had. Sometimes people bring in, you know, a piece of cloth that you might use for something, or jewelry, or even, you know, just a piece of raw metal that they might have. But it could be anything. And the person sees this and steals. And it was out of weakness. They look at it and say, listen, no one's going to miss this, you know, whatever. And the person takes this, and it can be, you know, as we have, for example, with Achan, that he steals it's called a tongue of gold, basically a piece of gold, and a certain garment that someone had in their camp. And in his case, this was a person that did this at a very, very specific time. This was a time when there was a clear command not to steal anything. There's no bounty. There's nothing. You have to leave everything out there. So this was a little different. The situation there was very, very, it was actually very different, I would say. And what's interesting here is that the process is the person admits to their sin. They're not flogged. They might be condemned a little bit by society, but the fact the person comes forward before the Kohanim and says, listen, I stole. The Kohen says, okay, what did you steal? Now, I think it's quite obvious the person has to give it back. But what happens here as well is that the sin is weighed out and the person is actually given a value. They have to find a ram under a certain value. And the idea here is something educational. You thought of making money or off of stealing from the temple. Now you're going to have to not only give back what you took and add a fifth to it. Now the fifth is basically 20% of the value of the item. I've had this question brought before me in the past. You know, can I take, can I add, is it 25% or something like that? Do I take, you know, the value of what was taken plus the value of what you give back, and then on top of that give the fifth? No, it's the item itself and then the fifth of the value of the item. Basically you give it back 120%. But what's very intriguing here is the educational element of you have to also bring a sacrifice based on the value, and then that sacrifice is put on the altar and you get nothing off of the sacrifice. There's something very educational about it, that the person is shown the value of things. You thought of reducing gifts that God received. Now you have to take away from your own pocket, but not just any ram. You have to bring a certain value of a ram. So this question: what do you do if you don't come find a ram by that price? Maybe they give him time. Maybe he brings the closest that he can, and then the rest of the money he has to give to the temple. Practical side of it is always something that has to be dealt with when you actually reach it. So there's a few things I wanted to point out about sin, sacrifice, and a small thing about the last week's parasha as well. But we have this whole section here, always giving back a fifth. You know, for the general rule is that, at least in my opinion, is that if a person, for example, has an item at home that they've dedicated for something, and if there's some money they dedicated for something to do with a commandment of God or something they're supposed to give to a sanctuary, whatever it might be, you know, or for example, in our world, if a person, we for example, remove what's known as chala, which by the way, the word chala appears here a couple of times, but the term chala means a piece of dough. When we make bread, under certain criteria, we remove a small piece out of it, and it's usually burnt because it's considered to be holy, and it's supposed to be given to a Kohen, but it's also done in an unpure state, and therefore no one can eat it, so we burn it. It's like a funny limbo. It's sanctified, but it's actually unclean. And if someone eats that by mistake, then the person goes, and he goes to a Kohen, and I've actually done this in the past, that you go to a Kohen, and you say, listen, we had a challah, its value was, say, I don't know if it's like the size of a roll, the value is such and such, and you go to a Kohen and you give him the value of the challah plus another 20% of it. So I don't know, I gave the Kohen like 5 shekels or something like that, 5 Israeli shekels just to be on the safe side. And he said, no, I accept this, and that was it. But the idea here is that you're compensating for any damage that might exist. So now what we have here in Parashat Tzav, and I know I spoke a lot here about last week's parasha, but it's all really one gigantic piece, really Vayikra, Tzav, this is just really one huge section that deals with the temple and the temple sacrifices and everything. And then chapter 9 already, next week's Parashah is already a new storyline. But what we have here, first of all, is a description of real temple service, how things were done. So the first thing that we have here in chapter 6 is that the first act you do in the temple is you have to clear the space to work. So what does it mean to clear your space to work? A kohen gets up in the morning, because remember, the kohanim used to live in the temple itself. This is especially, I think, the best depiction is what we have with the Mishkan Shiloh, the Tabernacle of Shiloh, where it's very clear that Eli and his sons actually live in the vicinity of the temple. Now, if you go to Shiloh today, there's an area there. As you go up the tell, and then you go down a little bit to the slope, north, kind of like northwest side of the slope there, there's actually an area that's assumed to be the section where the tabernacle was. I actually once made a video, and I lost the video. I don't know where the video is today, but I made a short video for friends of mine just to show them, and it was on my phone. I think I lost the phone or something. But in any case, the process is that Kohen actually lives in the vicinity of the temple, not in the temple itself, but in the vicinity. And the first thing you do is you go and you clear off the altar, because you've been having sacrifices throughout the day, and then you have bits and pieces that have to stay there to be completely consumed. So obviously you're going to have ashes and dirt on the altar itself. So the first thing a Kohen does is he goes up there, he pulls off whatever ashes are left up there. Okay, but he has to be dressed in priestly garments, which is because it's a priestly where you're actually going on the altar itself. As we established, the top of the altar or the altar itself is already considered to be a sanctified area. And he removes and he places the ashes near the altar. And then when he's done with that, then he removes his priestly garments and he wears mundane clothing and he takes the ashes out. And then the ashes become unsanctified, because basically the material is still there, and he takes it out into a pure place outside of the encampment. But from that point on, I think it really takes a mundane level. It's not very clear what happens with this, because if we're talking about a full functional altar, then hundreds of people come, it's going to be a large quantity. So what exactly do you do with all these ashes, with all these remains? It has to be a pure place, which means probably not anywhere near a graveyard or a bathroom or anything like that. But the question that still hangs here is, what is the status of these ashes after they're done? And I know that in the Second Temple period, certain things were actually used to fertilize fields, because the quantities were enormous. But it doesn't prove that this is what you're supposed to do. It's just one of these little, I would say, black holes of information that the Torah doesn't really expand upon anymore. And then the other thing is that he organizes the wood on the top of the altar. And then he has to bring the morning sacrifice, obviously. But what's very interesting here is, even such a mundane, such a small thing, the Torah goes into extent to explain this to us, because every action done on the altar is considered to be an important action. Even cleaning the altar is considered to be an important action. The Mishnah describes that there was this, the Kohanim would wake up very early in the morning. They were the ones that, they would raffle between themselves who does which work. And they were all interested. There were so many Kohanim, they actually broke it down to several stages. And they had this tool known as a psachtal, which is basically a large barrel that they would put in ashes, and it would sit next to the altar, and then they'll take it out. But they will raffle these different little jobs. The Kohanim, obviously the Mishnah is describing things on an ideal level, but the way it's described is the Kohanim were interested. This is a mistract of Tamid. The Kohanim were interested, and they were raffling between them who does which job, and they're all very happy to do it. Obviously, that's a description of the Second Temple, a larger temple. Here we're talking about a small temple. This is still in the level of the Mishkan, and they... obviously, there's a small quantity of Kohanim that do all this work, and each morning someone else does it. But it's pretty amazing that even such a small detail is actually described here. And then we go into another stage here, which is the rule of how to actually sacrifice a grain offering. Now, obviously, grain offerings were done based on using flour. So the basic grain offering here is based on flour with oil and frankincense. And the whole idea is that it does what's called as a kometz. A kometz is basically grabbing a quantity with your fist. Okay? Now, do you use all your fingers, only part of your fingers? Obviously, a thumb is not involved. But the quantity itself is basically what you can actually fit into the small space that develops when you fold in your fingers. And this is referred to as the azkara, the mentioning, which really means the pinching. So a kometz is really a pinch, but it's a large, it's not a pinch that you do with your thumb and your index finger or anything like that. It's more of a quantity that you take with your entire hand. Why is it referred to as a kometz? Because it's done with, I think their name is that the finger just before your pinky is known as the kmitza. So if you close that finger, the rest of the fingers follow, but your pinky can stick out. So some describe it as being just the three fingers, the three middle fingers, including the thumb and the pinky, and that's really what you pull out. But the idea is that you take a small quantity with the oil and the frankincense, and that's what burns on the altar, and the rest of it is given to the Kohanim, because really eating in the ancient world was very grain-based, and the Kohanim wouldn't only eat meat, they had to have their carbs, and that's one of the sources. Now, it was also offered as matzot. Now, the word matzot here is really used in the sense of no leaven whatsoever. Whatever they do with it afterwards, depending on the type of sacrifice, the type of, if it's done in a frying pan or a skillet or in a bowl or whatever it might be, the it always has to be in a state that's known as matzah, which is basically unleavened. And the text really does give us a detailed description here of another type of offering that shows up here, which is one done in a skillet. And there's a very unique word here, which is murbechet. This is chapter 6, verse 14. This word murbechet is very, very unusual. And there are a lot of different interpretations here. But the one thing that's very clear is that the sacrifice at one point has to come out as like little bits. I would almost argue it's almost like couscous or something like that, but not necessarily. This could be, you know, tufine min hat pitim. So pitim comes with patat, which is little bits. So I'm saying it's like couscous, because couscous, if you ever see traditional couscous, what they do is they have a kind of quasi-soft dough, and then they would roll it in there between their hands, and then it would turn into little bits. That's what traditional couscous is made. And the practice here is something that they could eat. Now, we know that the type of, from some descriptions, you know that the lowest type of bread that could exist, because the word lechem is a very general word for food, the lowest type of lechem you can have is a type of gruel. The theories are that the first breads in the world were not really bread as we know them today. They were really just, you know, like very soft, doughy gruel that you could eat, where you really ate with your fingers. But it wasn't like bread that you open up and it's like all the rising of the bread, and you open up and you tear it apart, like, you know, like many of us enjoy doing as a former baker as well. So yes, I did work as a baker, not just as a chef, but also as a baker, you know, pulling out a fresh batch of bread and then letting it cool down for a few minutes and tearing upon eating it for breakfast. It's everyone knows it's a fun thing. I mean, even those who avoid gluten and everything. But in any case, enough with the food and the details of what people eat for breakfast. The idea here is the word murbechet is very unusual, because as far as I know, it appears only one time in the entire Tanakh. And I've tried to find the etymology of this word, but it's not clear. But the root rabach, or maybe even the form, might be that we're looking at some kind of metathesis. Words are moving, or letters are moving around, but the different theories are that it means that it's something which was fried. Basically, it's broken and thrown into oil and frying in oil. It might mean the word soft, or it might mean something that's done quickly. It might be even all three. It's not clear at all, but this is a very, very unusual thing. And this grain offering is done by the Kohen HaMashiach. This is the... there's a bit of a debate if this is something a Kohen would do every day. Was there a grain offering offered every single day? Or was this what we can call a dedicating sacrifice? The Kohen, the first sacrifice that he does is the simplest one that can exist, which is a grain offering. And the high priest, when he turns into the high priest, when he takes the position of the person before him, if it's his actual father, or if there's no possibility like that, then the next person, that he actually does this as a dedication ceremony. The Mishnah describes it as something that was done every single day, and I think it's referred to as Minchat Kohen Gadol, and I think the Mishnah, if I remember correctly, actually describes that any Kohen does this, that the Kohen Gadol wasn't always in the temple, and therefore someone under him would do it in his stead on every single day. This is not very clear. The text doesn't really tell us. Let's be very precise here. Actually, I'm looking at the text now more in detail, and actually says in verse 13, "Beyom himashehoto," the day when he is dedicated. So this seems to be more fitting to the idea of this is a dedicating sacrifice, and instead of doing something complex and messy with an animal and so on, the first sacrifice a high priest would do is the simplest sacrifice that there is. All he has to do is function as a high priest on the most lowest level that can exist, and now he's the high priest. And we can see that action is very, very important in the temple. Then we have detailed descriptions here regarding the sacrifices themselves. That where do you slaughter the animal, which actually it says very clearly, that you slaughter the chatat and the ola in the same place. Traditionally, they say it's in the north. This is really what the Mishnah says. I remember it should say somewhere. I don't remember exactly where, but it should say somewhere about slaughtering near the north. It might not even say that. I'm just trying to remember because I have one of the problems you have is when you grow up inside a very specific system, is that your mind automatically tries to go somewhere without really knowing if that information really exists. But what's important here as well is that you would say there's a certain level here of logic that it should be somewhere in the north. The north in a lot of cultures was considered to be a sanctified area. And also, if we say that the ramp was in the south, and according to Jewish tradition, the ramp was in the south, then the northern side will be the nearest area to the altar, which is already inside the line of the altar. That's not occupied, because between the altar and the tabernacle, it's already there's the basin. But really, one may argue that basically you can do it anywhere in the court. I mean, that's the most logical thing. But in Jewish tradition, especially in the description of the Second Temple, the slaughterhouse was to the north, because in the south it was occupied with a gigantic ramp. And then east of the altar was too close to the general public, so they wouldn't do anything there. Then we have... we have these levels here of sacrifice that you refer to as Kodesh Kodashim. And basically, Kodesh Kodashim means Holy of Holies. So you have this ranking of sacrifices. You have sacrifices which are considered to be sacrifices which are Kodesh Kodashim, which means there's a sacrifice that only the Kohen eats from, or it's completely burnt. The Ola, the burnt offering, is considered to be Kodesh Kodashim. The Asham, the guilt offering, is referred to here as Kodesh Kodashim. And what we have here are sacrifices that only a Kohen is allowed to do. Versus other sacrifices like the Shlamim, which are considered to be... we also have the Chatatia, which is obviously also a type of Kodesh Kodashim. And what we have here is that these are sacrifices only eaten by the Kohen, only dealt with by the Kohen. The owner of the sacrifice has no part in the sacrifice itself. And it actually also stipulates the type of mincha, the type of grain offering that goes with the asham, which means it has to be something which is clear that you always give a grain offering with it. And I always find it very intriguing why a sacrifice has to show up with a grain offering. And in truth, I don't really necessarily have an answer, but I think there's something very symbolic in bringing a sacrifice, which is from the animal realm, and a grain offering, which is the earth, and they both symbolize the covenant of the land, that our presence on the land that God gave us is connected to the idea of us keeping the covenant. And the land is, you don't bring pieces of earth, so you bring what symbolizes the land. So what's intriguing is that animals are also considered to be part of the blessing of the land. So I think that the entire temple system, the entire mechanism of the temple, is directly connected to the land. It is our key, it is our doorway and key to being in the land. And the sacrifices are there to cleanse any barriers and any embellishments that can exist that prevent us from being on the land. And the way we cleanse the land is by things of the land. And that's probably why they always have to show up also with a grain offering, because it's a very clear, it's not just an animal, you know, just bringing an animal as food for the gods. I mean, yes, in the ancient world, sacrifices were considered to be food of the gods. You have the story of the Sumerian story of the flood, and the gods were starving, and when they bring the sacrifices, were all over it like flies, which is kind of funny that they use the term flies, but that's basically what they did. That's how it's described there. And here I think that the idea is not to represent as food of a god, but really to be something symbolic of our presence of the land, of our covenant, which is directly connected to the land. Being in the land is the blessing, being off the land is the curse. Now we also have your other small details, like for example, the todah, the thanksgiving. We have a type of shlamim, which is the thanksgiving. I was actually asked this week, I have a Sunday group that I teach. It's kind of funny. It's not Sunday class. No, I keep on thinking it's not a Sunday class. But I have a group that I teach on Sundays. I teach the Torah step by step, every chapter, trying to analyze as much as we can. It's a very slow study. And I was asked, we reached 100 lessons. And I was asked, so what kind of sacrifice would we bring? And the sacrifice I'd say would be a todah, which is a thanksgiving. And the thanksgiving is very interesting, is it's brought together with chalot matzot, berulot bashemen. So these are chalot. The word chalot really comes from the root chalal, which is a space. But the problem is that these are also chalot matzot. So how can you have a chala, which comes from the word chalal or chalul, which indicates the idea of something which has risen and there are areas with air pockets, but it's also matzot. So my usual interpretation would be that these are probably thick loaves. From the outside, it looks like a challah, which is a thick bread, unlike flatbreads that most of us may know. For example, pita bread or lafa, or as we call it in Jerusalem, they call it eshtanol, which are basically large flatbreads without a pocket, versus thicker breads, which have no pockets as well, but they also look like a normal roll or normal loaf of bread that we see today, but these would be a state of matzah. How do you exactly consume such a thing? I have no idea. I remember when we were making bread, and if you don't put any yeast or something and you pull it out, it's very difficult to eat such a thing. So I really have no idea how they would eat this, unless they would soak it inside the juices or something and then eat it with that. But here the offering is given as chalot matzot berulot bashemen. They're mixed with oil. Now, I don't think it means... maybe berulot bashemen actually would be the answer, that you eat this bread, but it has to be dipped in oil, and the oil is used as a way of softening it and being able to make it easier to eat it. That might be it. By the way, that might be it, because then it says v'rekikim matzot meshuchim bashamin. Rekikim, rakak is really a flat bread. This is already like little crackers. Rakik today is really what we can compare as a cracker, but they're spread with oil. So you brush oil over them. Mashach is to anoint, but here it basically means you pour some oil, you brush some oil on top of them. And then v'sarot murbechet, so we have this word here again. I said it only happens once, but really it's still so it doesn't happen only once, but it really happens here inside this closed system of Leviticus. And v'sarot murbechet halot be'olot b'shamin. So again, some kind of action that's done with the solid itself, with the flour. And then it's also in a state of chalot be'olot b'shamin. These are also these type of thicker breads which are placed in oil. But then what's very intriguing here is that the Todah, besides these two or three types of bread, there's also chalot lechem chametz. There are only two cases in the entire sacrificial system where you bring leaven. They don't go on the altar, but they show up, and it's here, leavened bread, lechem chametz, and also with the two loaves of bread, which happen on Shavuot. Now, why leaven here? So I would say this is a meal. And the Todah is you bring to the altar because you're presumably communing with your God. Before God, you bring chalot matzot, you bring a matzah state bread. But for you yourself to consume it, this is supposed to be a human meal as well. And this is like a very, I would say very, if we accept what some scholars say, a very primitive type of sacrifice. And therefore, it's supposed to be part of your own meal as well. So you eat it with bread that's actually what most people would eat, which is leaven. And what's interesting, it has to be eaten on the same day. So I think it was probably customary to invite people over. That you do this is not something you do with one individual goes and brings the Korban Todah. You would invite people over to celebrate with you, because the Todah is a Thanksgiving. There's a certain element of celebration here, and it makes sense that you, if you don't have enough people, you don't have much family, then you also invite friends, and you celebrate together whatever you're thanking upon. But then you also have neder and nedava. Neder is to speak. It's not an oath, really. There's a difference between neder and shvuah. Shvuah is an oath, and neder is a dedication. You dedicate something, or you make a promise that you will bring something, or you dedicate an animal, and you make a promise that you bring this animal as a sacrifice. Or nedava. Nedava is this from your own free will. For some reason, you just decide, oh, look, this would be a great animal to bring as a sacrifice. And you never speak words that you take an oath, you know, some kind of an oath that you'll do such and such because of whatever, because the neder is a structure that's used to you make a promise, and then you solidify your promise with something that's physical, something that's in the real world. Versus, and that's basically the idea. So some arbitrary promise. You actually say something very clear. Well, nedava is just out of your good spirits. For some reason, you decide to bring a certain sacrifice. Those sacrifices you're supposed to eat over a period of about 2 days. On the third day, you have to burn it because it's referred to as pigul. Pigul is something which has been spoiled, something which is damaged. And anyone who eats it, is sinned against God and has to purify themselves and probably also bring a sacrifice. Now, what also happens here in chapter 7, so a very interesting discussion that I had a very long time ago with a relative, is first of all the presence of chapter 7, verse 22 to 27. Now, I spoke about this little section, something similar to this last week, I'm going to clarify this again. First of all, there are in some Bibles, when you open it up, this section is actually separate. It's a separate part. There's what's known as a parasha. There's a space between here. In some versions, like for example, the Tanakh I have in front of me, it's actually connected. It's very interesting, this whole argument of where do you put spaces and everything. It's a different discussion. But what's very important here is the following. It says, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, lemo, saying, Kol chelev shor v'chesev v'ez lo tochelu. All the chelev. Now, how do you define chelev? Chelev is the body parts that we find described earlier in the previous parasha in chapters 1 and 2 of body parts of the animal which are removed, different fats, different intestines, you know, kidneys, not intestines, but, you know, the fat which covers the belly itself, the kidneys with their fat, part of the liver. These are referred to as chelif. These are not fat. These are not necessarily considered to be fat. These are all the parts which are to be placed on the altar, and we have kidneys and part of the liver. So it's obviously not just fat. But it says, all the chelev of an ox, a sheep, and a goat you would not eat. Now, these three animals, they actually have, most of these chalavim are the same, except for the sheep. The sheep in our region here in the Mediterranean, sheep also have what's known as fat tail. Now, you don't always see this with a lot of sheep that are raised in Europe or South America. Sorry, not South America, New Zealand or Australia. But the variety that we have here in the Middle East have huge tails. And these tails accumulate massive quantities of fat. Some of these tails are just huge. And very commonly it's used as, for example, in gyro meat. You have what's known as shawarma that we have on the top. You have some fat that's actually tail fat. Mediterranean kebab, the sometimes would use tail fat to spice it up. I mean, tail fat has to be used in small quantities because it has a very potent flavor. But the point is that you have to be careful with this because this is one of those fats. Now, there is an argument. There is someone who makes a claim, says, oh, this only happens in the sacrifices. And the warning here is that don't try to snag any of these pieces of fat from the sacrifice. These actually have to go on the altar. But then I ask a question. There's a question here of association, because then verse 24 says, V'chelev nevela v'chelev trefa yaseh lechol melechan. The chelev of the dead animal, an animal drops dead, or trefa, which is torn by a wild animal, can be used for any work. So, yes, there is a section here that deals with the temple sacrifices, but then the association with fat or chelev of animals, which you find more in the general world, in the mundane world, you can use them for work, which excludes the possibility of eating them. So this is not limited just to sacrifices. This actually pours into our world today. But it says, "V'achol lo tochlu," and you will surely not eat it. Okay? So, in Judaism today, we avoid all these different fats, colon fat, the fat which is on the kidneys themselves, but that's the thing. It's only the fats. The kidneys, that's the argument here. Is the chelev relating just to the fat? Or does it relate to the parts themselves? The body parts themselves as well, the kidneys and the liver. I would say on the safe side, it includes the kidneys and that part of the liver. Though I would understand someone who argues, well, you know, if you look at the way it's structured in I think it's like Leviticus 1 or 2, when it describes, it's Leviticus 3, sorry, where it talks about, when it says, you know, Cherev amechaset akerev, the colon fat, et kol hachev asher akerev, and all the fat which is on the stomach, v'chte akleyot, v'tachelev asher alehen, one may argue very easily that the chelev asher alehen clearly indicates that there's a difference between the kidney and the chelev, which seems to be the fat which is upon them. So yes, I would accept an argument that says that kidneys are perfectly fine, but then we also have a problem with the usage of the word chelev as being something which it means the prime part. So, yes, some in Judaism they say the kidney is not part of the chelev. Karaites say the kidneys are part of the thing known as chelev. Whatever the opinion may be, anyhow, buying, for example, large animal kidneys are something you don't really find in stores anyhow, and liver is usually trimmed anyhow as well. So there's not really a chance of this happening anyhow. I mean, and most Westerners don't eat liver or kidneys, and here in Israel most of the liver and kidneys you find are chicken, so you really don't have that problem. But what's very important here is to indicate that it's not, as I said last week, it's not every fat. The tail fat, which is I think the biggest issue that we have here, is the the real problem. Because it's referred to as Chelbo Ha'aliyah Tamima. This is, if you go back to chapter 3, verse 9, it is referred to as a Chelev. Chelbo, it's Chelev. And therefore, it seems to be very clear that that does fall in the category of Chelev. So people ask the question, why is it that in Judaism people do eat the Chelev? Because and the answer is probably, first of all, probably because there were some people who believe that this prohibition is only on sacrifices, which is obviously an incorrect assumption. And there might have been some kind of that custom might have existed under a misunderstanding. And then what happened was it was such a widespread practice that certain people said, well, listen, it must be that this is allowed because, look, we actually practice it. This is obviously a theory. And then a midrash came out saying, well, if we eat this, obviously there's a reason. They say, oh, it has to be all the chelev, which is the same in the ox, the sheep, and the goat, which excludes, and this is what the Midrash in Chulin says, to exclude the tail fat, which does not exist in the ox and the goat. And this is how they explain why people eat the tail fat. In any case, we have here at the end of this parasha the dedication of Aharon and his sons, and there's a whole series of sacrifices here and ceremony of wearing the clothing. And it's basically a process. You transition from one stage to the other through the usage of these sacrifices. And anyone can read this because this is really straightforward. You know, there's a depiction of which parts are burnt, which parts are eaten. It doesn't say that they actually physically eat it. But the point is that you have parts which are given to Moshe. Moshe is officiating here as a type of Kohen, just for now, because there's no one else, and he is the highest level person amongst Israel. And what's interesting, just this, something I'm going to be writing about a little bit more on my blog, but what's very interesting here is the hidden number 7. The term, as the Lord commanded Moses, appears 7 times. It's very common for little bits and pieces like this to show up in different places and different texts. And I'm actually planning on writing a short article about hidden 7, places where the numeral 7 is hidden around the text. That there are 7 words of this or 7 times that, and it shows the planning of how these texts were written. This wasn't just done just because there was actually a lot of intelligence behind writing these texts. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this recording. As you can see, this week we're a bit under an hour. And again, if there are any questions, any things that I can help her out with, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Don't forget to like the Facebook page. If you've never heard of Hebrew in Israel, you can go to the Facebook page. Also the website, HebrewInIsrael.net. One word, no capital letters. And again, I always say if there are any questions that people have, things they want to make me made into videos or little recordings like this, just send me an email or leave a comment below. And don't forget to also share. Sharing is caring. It enables other people to know about this channel. And because I have people saying, oh, I never heard of you. Now I see this. And they're just writing back to me, so I heard this video and I heard that video. And so the more you share and the more you like and the more interaction there is, the more exposure anything receives. If it's Facebook, if it's YouTube, if it's the website, the more clicks a website has, the more popular it becomes on the searches. In any case, thank you for joining me again. And I hope you learned something new out of this. If not, that you've reviewed something you already know. And if you're listening to this during Shabbat, so Shabbat Shalom, or just before Shabbat, have a Shabbat Shalom. If you listen during the week, hope you had you're having a great week. And I will join you again next week for Parashat Shmini. Kol Tov.